The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by six local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today John B. Kachuba. His new novel is called The Savage Apostle. He joins us by telephone from Connecticut, but John is from our region. Hello, John. What town do you live in?
Hi, Vic. Well, I live in Cincinnati, just down the road from you a little bit.
Uh-huh. Actually in Cincinnati or one of the burbs?
No, I'm right in the city. I'm in the North Avondale neighborhood.
Okay. And this book, The Savage Apostle, is a historical novel set in a real time, in a real place, with real people that really lived. And I'm wondering how you got the inspiration for this one.
Right. Well, I grew up in New England. I grew up basically in Connecticut. I lived in Rhode Island for a while, and that's where Savage Apostle was set, in New England, in the late 17th century. The novel begins in 1675. And what it talks about are the events that led up to a confrontation between English colonists and the native peoples that was known as King Philip's War. It's very big in New England because the war was extremely destructive. It took New England almost a century to recover economically from the devastation in the war. And, of course, many of the native people, their populations were decimated by the war. So it's big here. It's a little footnote in American history. Not a lot of people know about King Philip's War or study it. I had been interested in it because, as I said, growing up here, I would drive along different areas and I'd see a little marker somewhere on the roadside and it would say, you know, this was the scene of a certain battle, or this is where, the Indians got together, or here's where the colonists had their fort. There's really no physical remains anymore, but there are those sort of milestones, and I was always intrigued by that. And so I said, you know, this is a history that I think needs to be written. There's a lot of nonfiction books about the war, but I don't think there's a whole lot taken from a historical novel perspective, historical fiction, which is what I like to do.
Well, I'm slightly familiar with this subject. We did have a book we featured a while back that talked about some of this region and some of these tribes, and that was Caleb's Crossing by Geraldine Brooks. We had her on. Like you say, is a little remembered period. The Savage Apostle. Now, is this referring to your narrator?
You know, it's an interesting question. People ask me that all the time, and it's sort of a tricky title because it could actually talk about a couple different people. The narrator, there's actually two narrators, and one is an English colonist named John Eliot, who was a missionary to the Indians. So he was called Apostle to the Indians. So he could be the Savage Apostle. However, there's also another key player in here, an Indian who was Christianized named John Sassaman, and he was a protege of John Eliot. He's found murdered at the beginning of the story, which is historical, and that is one of the things that sort of sets the stage for the confrontation later on. But he also was charged with going back to his own people and trying to convert them to Christianity. So in a sense, he too is the savage as an apostle. So it's kind of a play. It works on a couple levels for two of my characters, at least.
Well, your narrator, the guy who starts the story, Eliot, I guess I'd call him a missionary.
Right.
He really is narrating, but the other stuff, the other sections from Philip's standpoint, aren't really written as a narration.
That's correct.
Why did you choose to do it that way?
You know, I had some as I was writing this thing, I went back and forth in terms of point of view, and at one time, I didn't have any sort of pivotal character that carried the story. They're all taken from a third person point of view, as you know, just from the author's interpretation. But I wanted to be closer to that. And so I thought if I did John Eliot as a first person narrator, and you're exactly right, he opens it up and he speaks in the I voice. He's the first person. He is the narrator like that. It was easier, quite frankly, for me to probably get into his skin than it was for me to get into Philip or Metacom, who was the native sachem, who was his sort of adversary, if you will, in this. And Philip's point of view is third person. You're right. It comes from that point of view. Yet they're both carrying the story. But it was difficult for me to actually take on the sensibility of a 17th century Native American, which is certainly not my background, nor is a 17th century English colonist either. Uh-huh. But I felt at least a little bit closer to sort of that viewpoint, I guess, than I felt to the native viewpoint. Yet I really wanted to express the native viewpoint as fully as I could as well. It was a tricky balancing act.
John Kachuba joins us. His novel is The Savage Apostle. Eliot, I think he did a really splendid job of looking through his eyes, because through his eyes we get that weird manifest destiny thing going on where he's convinced that these Native Americans need to find Jesus Christ. This is the only thing that's going to save them. He's just so convinced of this, and he's deeply troubled by all the things that are going on, yet he remains somewhat blind to reality because of his abiding faith.
I would agree with that. And the interesting thing about it that I think Eliot's attitude was common for a lot of people who had sort of the better intentions of the native people, that they felt the only way they could be Christianized was to, first of all, I mean, the only way they could be civilized and brought to society was to be Christian. Anything outside of Christianity, you just weren't, you know, you weren't a civilized person according to their worldview. So I think that was an important way of how they looked at it. But the interesting thing is that I really believe that that set up the basis for sort of the Americans' attitudes towards Native people in the following centuries. You know, right up until 19th century, in the 1800s, late 1800s. You had the Indian schools like Carlisle in Pennsylvania and so many in the Southwest. They're still there, where we thought it was Pratt. I forgot his first name. I think Henry Pratt, who founded Carlisle, and said that, you know, we have to beat the savage out of the Indian. And he meant to education. And that's what they did. They basically brought Indian kids into schools and took away their culture, wouldn't allow them to speak their native languages, cut their hair, made them wear, you know, Western-style clothing, you know, American-style clothing, if you will. And I think that was all set up way back in the 17th century, that the only way you can save what they called the red man was to take the red man out of him and make him a white man. And in those days, that meant, you know, a white Christian. So it's interesting how that mode followed through. I think it really all started right back in the 17th century there.
You also gave me my singular reading of it, the impression that Philip was this noble, tragic figure. Let's talk about the colonies, because this predated the original 13 colonies. These are just little colonies, aren't they?
That's right.
Tell us about this.
Yeah, and they're independent. You know, we all know about the pilgrims in 1620 landing at, well, you know, supposedly stepping on the Plymouth Rock and landing at Plymouth and starting this colony. Well, they did, and the colony they started was basically on the spot of an old Wampanoag, one of the native people. The Wampanoag were probably the predominant tribe in that area. There were various bands of Wampanoag, but the Wampanoag were the big, you know, sort of tribal affiliation. Where the pilgrims actually finally built their little village in Plymouth was actually literally on the bones of an old Wampanoag village that had been basically decimated by white disease, you know, European diseases brought over in the decades before by itinerant fishermen on the banks of New England and things like that. So they actually started right there in that little colony. And that colony was different from just the one that was started maybe, you know, 40 miles north or so in Boston. That was the Massachusetts Bay Colony. That was a separate colony. And then you had colonies in Connecticut. You had New Haven, and you had other colonies like that. So, you know, we sort of think of, if we don't know a lot about old New England history, we kind of think of, yeah, like the Pilgrims came and settled. And it was like this big colony, which isn't, in fact, true. There were scattered settlements. And all around those settlements were various Native peoples. You know, the Wampanoag primarily in southeastern New England. As you went a little bit further west, you come into the Pequot, sort of in roughly the eastern half of Connecticut, moving down west. You know, they were big. Mohegan. I mean, you had these other tribes that were completely surrounding all these little settlements. So it wasn't like the Europeans had set up some solid state, you know, that could defend itself on all borders or whatever. So we had a situation like that where the colonists overestimated entirely the strength and, you know, population of the natives that surrounded them. They always felt that they were outnumbered and that these, you know, were huge towns out there and everything else, when in fact the native population had already been really, really chopped down to almost half its population, if not less, by disease, even before the pilgrims settled there. The natives, on their hand, recognized that, you know, we have newcomers here who have some technology and all that we're not privy to. How do we negotiate this? You know, do we try to kick them out? Do we try to destroy them? Do we try to ally ourselves with them? And so when you have Plymouth settled in 1620, the Wampanoag, about a year later, actually sit down with the leaders at Plymouth and negotiate I don't want to say a truce because there was no warfare, but they negotiate a treaty. And for about 50 years, there's peace between the Wampanoag people surrounding them and the Pilgrim population in Plymouth. But then that population grows. The Pilgrim population grows. There's need for more land, more resources. They're pushing out into areas that natives were fishing in, or, you know, hunted game, or even in native cornfields. And it just became, the pressure on the native people just became too much to bear. And there was no place to go. Philip finds himself in an unusual position because he recognizes that a war with Plymouth and probably other colonies who would come to its aid would be devastating for the native people. And he realizes that, but at the same time, he's getting a lot of pressure from the people within his own band. He represented the Pokanoket band of the Wampanoag, as well as other tribal members in neighboring tribes, saying, "We've got to fight these folks." And so he finds himself in an untenable position. You know, he knows he really can't win one way or the other. I guess what he hopes for is the best outcome. Maybe not total devastation, maybe some accommodation later on. But it doesn't work out for him that way.
And poor Philip, the whole thing kind of got dumped in his lap. His father had been the leader, and then his older brother, and then Philip. Do you think his older brother, Alexander, was poisoned?
You know, there's some, well, first of all, you know, his father, you mentioned his father. We need to go back to him a little bit. His father was Massasoit, who was one of the names that, you know, even school kids growing up in New England, you know, you learn about Thanksgiving and everything else, and you learn about the good Massasoit, you know, this wise sachem who maintained the peace for a long time. When he died, his oldest son, Wamsutta, who the pilgrims called Alexander, took over. And he didn't have that position very long before he mysteriously dies. It looks like some kind of a fever, but he was just on his way or returning from a meeting with Englishmen. And the natives believe that he was poisoned, that, you know, somebody among the English poisoned him, and on the return home, the poison kicks in and he dies. I don't know if he was actually poisoned or not. I don't really see a rationale for that. Philip, I don't think, who is the next brother in line, the next son in line, I don't think he was necessarily interested in taking over, so I certainly don't think it would have been from one of his own people. But I really can't see a motive for why the English would have poisoned him. They seem to have him pretty much in their control as it was. So I don't know what that's about. But there is that theory. And I do bring it out in the novel as a theory that, you know, I mean, a lot of the native folks think that, yes, he was poisoned. He was definitely poisoned by the English. I'm not sure that there's, like I said, I just can't understand the logic for that explanation. But there's no, we'll never know. You know, there's no, there's no evidence one way or the other.
Well, in this crazy high-tech age of ours today, if they knew where Alexander was buried, they'd probably want to exhume him and check it out and see if he really was poisoned. We'd have Geraldo Rivera, you know, narrating the thing. And I mean, didn't they just dig up an English king under a parking lot a few years ago? I mean, this it's crazy. The book is The Savage Apostle. John Kochuba wrote it. And as the book opens, as you indicated, this man has been found dead, and they were burying him in the first chapter, John Sassaman. This is a native who had converted and was Christian and had been one of Philip's trusted advisors until that kind of fell apart. And a lot of this story involves a courtroom drama because the settlers in Plymouth have brought three natives into their court to try them for the murder of this gentleman who they found in the pond. And this is a big part of the story. And the governor of Plymouth comes off as the villain throughout most of the book.
He does. At that point, that was Governor Winslow, and he was very ambitious. And I think that when you read some of the texts dating from that time, some of the primary sources and all, and I had to do a lot of research on this, I think it comes across that he was less willing to negotiate with the native people than say, John Eliot, who was, of course, a missionary and believed it was his Christian duty to do so, and some other folks. Like I mentioned, Benjamin Church in there, who was also, he lived on the frontier, more or less, as kind of a wild man, but he lived almost among the Indians and was respected by them and knew their ways pretty well. And he, too, kind of thought that, you know, this is not necessarily the way to go, to be so confrontational. But Winslow was different. He was young, and he had aspirations, and for him, I believe that the Indians were more an obstacle to the future growth of Plymouth, as well as other colonies in the area, and he simply saw them as people that needed, they were in the way of progress, and I don't know how many times we've heard that relative to native peoples in this country, you know, right through the centuries. They're in the way of progress, they're in the way of our farms, our agriculture, our mining, you know, whatever it is, they need to go. So, again, this is where it all begins.
My guest is John Kochuba. His novel is The Savage Apostle. And I should note that tomorrow John has an event in Centerville, in Washington Township, and you're going to be there at the library between 1 and 3 o'clock. Tell us what's going on, John.
That's right. I'll be at the main library, and there'll be two writers. We'll both be there. I think you had Raul on your show, I think, a couple days ago or so, or last week perhaps, and he'll be there as well. We are going to be there to meet and greet the folks. We'll talk about our books, and we'll have books available for sale. So I hope it's a good day. I hope people turn out for this. This is a new project for the Centerville Public Library. And it's called Second Monday. They're going to be doing this for a couple of weeks. And we'll be at the main branch of the library. And I don't have the exact street address, but it's the main one. I hope people do support it. I think it's a great program, and I'd like to see that go well for the library.
Well, we love our libraries here in the Book Nook. And John will be there talking about The Savage Apostle tomorrow. That's September 12th. At the Washington Centerville Library from 1 to 3 o'clock, and he'll be with Raul Ramos y Sanchez, who was on the program the other day with his book, The Skinny Years. They'll be there together. John, this is a little different book for you, isn't it? How many books have you written? Haven't you written a lot of books?
This is number 8. Yes, it is different. I'm probably known more for my ghost books. I have 4 books that talk about ghosts and ghost hunting. They're nonfiction, and 2 of them are about Ohio. Ghost Hunting Ohio and Ghost Hunting Ohio on the Road Again. So, yeah, I'm known for that, and I do a lot of speaking on that subject, both on radio and at conferences and on television and things like that. But I've always been interested in history and historical fiction, and I'm moving in that direction, you know, as well, too. So I'm covering a lot of different bases here.
Well, I hate to bring up the haunted thing, but Halloween is just around the corner. How did you get into that?
Well, you know, again, it goes back to growing up in New England, in Connecticut, because as a kid growing up here, not only did I hear all the history, the real stuff, but I also heard all the tales of, you know, witches and ghosts and all that you think of, you know, haunted New England cemeteries and everything, and it all came sort of with the overall history. And they always intrigued me. I've always been interested in the question, the metaphysical question of, you know, is there something after death and whatever. But I never really wrote about those things until I met Ed and Lorraine Warren, who lived in Connecticut and were sort of considered the godfather and godmother of American ghost hunting. Ed Warren has since passed away, but Lorraine, who is, well, she's got to be 80 by now, is still on the circuit, on television a lot and TV. They were the people that investigated the Amityville Horror, and it seems like people always know that when you say the Amityville Horror, the famous book and famous movie. So I met them. I lived in the same town, and I went to their house a couple times and interviewed them and sort of got interested in it, in writing about it at that point, although even then it was a delay before I finally got around to doing it. But yeah, so it's been interesting. I've met a lot of interesting people in doing that, and come October, as you mentioned, Halloween, I'll be in various locations around the state of Ohio speaking at libraries in October about ghosts and those books. I mean, I do that every year. So that's on my website. People can check that out.
I had a funny feeling that you probably were up to something in October. His website is johnkachuba.com. That's K-A-C-H-U-B-A. And we've had Chris Woodyard on the program a couple times. And
oh, yeah.
I always think of her as kind of the queen of spooky Ohio. So are you the king or the crown prince of spooky Ohio?
Well, that'd be a nice honor. I mean, I know Chris's Haunted Ohio series has been around forever, and I think there's, I don't know, 8 books in that series maybe or something. But, yeah, I mean, I'm doing pretty well right behind her, I guess, so I'm not complaining too much.
And you've done other states, right, besides Ohio?
I did. I wrote Illinois, and then I ended up editing that series for the publisher, Clarissy Press. And so I brought in probably another 10 books from, you know, Florida, Kentucky, Maryland, you know, whatever, across the country, hired writers in each one of those states to go out and do the same thing that I did in Ohio and Illinois, which was to personally go to these places, visit them, interview folks, and then write about them. So right now in that series, the publisher calls it America's Haunted Road Trip. There's probably about 15 books in that series by now, I think, if not more.
I would have to think that if you had an opinion about the most haunted state, you would probably choose a state in New England. Do you have an opinion?
Well, I mean, New England's got a lot. But I have to tell you, after writing those two Ohio books, you know, when I give my talks in October at various libraries, I'm amazed, Vic, because people always come to me afterwards and they say, hey, do you know about, you know, the old brewery? And I say, what? You know, right down the street. I said, really? You know, they always have places that are haunted that I didn't write about. Mm. So I could probably do another Chris Woodyard and write another 4 or 5 books about Ohio. So I'm going to go with Ohio.
All right. Well, just down the street from our studio at the Trail Tavern, it's supposedly haunted. So yeah.
Yes, absolutely. That's in my book. That's in Ghost Hunting Ohio.
There you go. And you're from Cincinnati, or you live in Cincinnati now. And
right.
Cincinnati's got some pretty creepy haunted stuff in it.
It does. Mm-hmm. It does. One of the very first places that I wrote about in Cincinnati was the Music Hall, which is, you know, a big, beautiful edifice built in 1872. But one of the famous journalists from Cincinnati, Lafcadio Hearn, wrote about as the workers were digging the foundation, uncovering bodies because it was built on an old potter's field. And the very first time there was some kind of an exposition at the center once it was built about seeing ghosts right there the first time. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting things in Cincinnati, too.
Ooh. My guest is John Kachuba. And we digressed from the Savage Apostle to ghosts, but we do have Halloween coming up, so we are kind of gearing up for that. It's cooling off a little bit, and the leaves are starting to fall, and the pumpkins are ripening on the vines. And in New England, back in the day, Philip's War was about to begin, and we get right to the end of your book, and we experience some of what happened in Philip's War. And what a sympathetic character Philip is in your telling. I like him. I feel sorry for him. He's so doomed and tragic. How did you imagine him?
Well, exactly that way. I mean, I really thought that he was, for lack of a better word, basically a good guy, that he wanted to live his life. He wanted to, you know, raise his children. He wanted what we all want. He wanted to live in peace. He wanted to raise his family, see his kids go on to whatever, grow up. But he also wanted to live his tradition, his lifestyle. And there's a sort of underlying, I don't know if it's a moral to the novel or not, but I say that this novel is not just a story about the 17th century, but that it has implications for today. Because I think really what's going on in the novel is that there's racial and religious intolerance. Now, whether it comes from mean-spirited folks or just ignorance or whatever, it doesn't matter. It still comes down to intolerance for people that are different from you, in terms of what they believe, you know, spiritually, or how they live their lives, you know, the color of their skin. And so it ends up with this, you know, horrible confrontation. And we are still living with racial and religious intolerance. We change the names of the people. We change the locations, change the dates. But it's the same thing. It's the same thing. And so I think Philip just said, look, you know, I have my way of living. You have your way of living. You know, can't we just do it? Can't we just be together in a community, but, you know, without forcing world views on each other or opinions on each other? Mm-hmm. Can't we just all be? And so I really felt that's what he was looking for. And in that sense, he does become a tragic figure because that's just not the way it was going to go. Mm-hmm. You know, it was against him from the beginning, and he was fighting an uphill battle to maintain his traditions and his beliefs, and it just wasn't going to work out.
My guest has been John Kachuba. His novel is The Savage Apostle, and he's got an event tomorrow coming up in Centerville, Washington Township. We have just enough time for one quick question. You got something in the hopper? Are you working on another book?
Yeah, I do. I'm working on two right now. Actually, I'm under contract to write a book for a UK publisher on shapeshifters.
Oh.
So there I go, back to the paranormal again, right?
All right.
So that'll be interesting. But then I'm also working on a historical novel. I mentioned Lafcadio Hearn, a 19th century journalist in Cincinnati, and I'm working on a historical novel about his life. He's a very interesting character. So I've got a couple of projects going on right now.
Wonderful. And he has a great name, Lafcadio.
Oh, I love it.
My guest has been John Kachuba. He will be at the Washington Centerville main branch tomorrow, along with Raul Ramos y Sanchez. They'll be talking about their books, and that's between 1 and 3 o'clock at the library. I'm sure you can go to the library website for more information. John, we really appreciate your time today.
Well, Vic, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. The book is The Savage Apostle by John B. Kachuba. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in.